From KALW in San Francisco, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. NBC News is reporting that members of Congress are concerned that all undocumented immigrants in the United States, all 11 million, are at risk of deportation. They came to this conclusion after meeting with a top immigration and customs enforcement official. The Associated Press is reporting that the Trump administration is considering a plan to mobilize as many as 100,000 National Guard troops to detain immigrants, including millions living nowhere near the Mexico border. The 11-page document obtained by the AP calls for the unprecedented militarization of immigration enforcement as far north as Portland, Oregon, and as far east as New Orleans, Louisiana. This morning, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said the report is 100% not true. Joining us to discuss these new developments and media coverage of the plight of immigrants are three journalists. Nicholas Kung is a reporter with the Toronto Star, where he covers immigration, refugee, migrant, and diversity issues, and he joins us from Toronto. Hi, Nicholas. Welcome to the show. We are also joined today by Roque Planas, national reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers immigration, and Roque joins us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Roque. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks.
Great. Nice to have you. Julio Ricardo Varela is a senior digital editor for Latino USA, NPR's only national Latino news and cultural weekly radio show. Julio is also the founder of LatinoRebels.com. That's a website that uses humor, commentary, and analysis to explore the U.S. Latino world. And Julio joins us from Boston. Hi, Julio. Welcome. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight good journalism that stood out this week. So, Roque, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
I think, one of the things that I like to do is take a break from just reading about immigration all the time. So, I picked up a copy of The New Yorker when I was on a flight, and there was this big sort of extensive piece about a SWAT team in Iraq, where sort of the requirement to join is that you be have either lost a relative or to ISIS or something to that effect. You have to have been affected personally. It's called The Avengers of Mosul, and it's written by Luke Mogelson. And I think what struck me about it, right, is, my grandfather was in the Cuban Revolution, and one of the things, if you were to ask him why he got involved in that, he wouldn't tell you anything political. What he would say was that his best friend died in the attack on Moncada, right? And that was what prompted him to join the revolution. And I think for a lot of people, we tend to understand these big conflicts in terms of ideology and politics. And I think that this reporter did an absolutely fantastic job of, number one, highlighting that personal element that sort of drives conflict. And then number two, really telling it in this way that, he was embedded for a long time and really has just very detailed constructions of scene. It's an absolutely sort of masterful piece of reporting. So I'd encourage people to read it also, because I think it's a very extreme case. Most people don't live in a situation of war, but I think in a time of a lot of sort of heightened rhetoric, it's very good to sort of look at people's personal experiences as closely as you can to see how that translates to people's actual lived lives.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you for that one. That one was on my list. I'm hoping to read that over the weekend. Nicholas, what about you? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Can you hear us?
Hello?
Nicholas, can you hear us?
Hello?
All right, we're having some technical issues. Julio, are you with us? Well, Roque, we're having some problems on our end, so why don't we dive in while we try to get our other two guests? And let's talk about the breaking news that happened this morning. We were going to talk about yesterday's A Day Without Immigrants actions and then the ICE raids, and all of a sudden we were hit with this new news. So let's talk about this Associated Press report that's getting a lot of attention. The AP got its hands on an 11-page document that says the Trump administration is considering a plan to mobilize mobilize as many as 100,000 National Guard troops to detain immigrants, including millions of people living nowhere near the Mexico border, places like Portland and New Orleans. This morning, the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, came out and said this report is 100% not true. So first off, what are your thoughts on this AP piece?
You know, I think it's complicated right now because when you look at the way the administration has handled these executive orders, it looks like there's a lot of drafts circulating around and we don't know which ones are going to be policy and which ones don't. Now, it's obviously significant that they're even considering it. And for a little bit of context, if you're talking about mobilizing 100,000 people to go after unauthorized immigrants, you're talking about a force that would be more than double the combined size of Border Patrol and ICE, right? ICE has about 20,000 employees. Border Patrol has about 25,000 active people on the border. So this would be huge. I don't know that it's officially under real consideration. It's very hard to know. You know, it's hard to know whether or not people are just simply litigating their cases in the press because they do or don't agree with them. It's hard to know what's actually going to translate into policy. But I think the general climate that Trump has created with this hostile rhetoric toward immigrants, you know, this news report, regardless of whether it translates into policy, is going to make people that much more nervous. And you talk to people that have been here for 20 years and they're freaking out. You know, I'm talking to people that, you know, don't want to leave their house anymore. They're worried that their husbands are going to come home from work. Kids that are bringing up these immigration arrests at school. So, I mean, I think the net effect is to contribute to that general climate of fear that we're seeing right now in immigrant communities.
And you're in Austin, Texas. I understand that ICE had cars parked in plain view of a school, which really frightened children.
Yeah, that's what I've heard from a few different people concerned, parents and teachers and so forth. And I think, you know, there was this workshop over the week that at UT where the former head of the Immigration Law Clinic, Barbara Hines, was noting, you know, that we have this longstanding memo since 2011 that says that ICE agents can't go to sensitive locations, right? Funerals, churches, schools. Now, we already know that in Alexandria, someone was arrested while leaving a church shelter by ICE agents. And you know, at least Professor Hines, right, parking outside of school would violate that guidance. It's the same as it's not quite the same as going into a school, right? But she says that they're very sort of comparable. And the net effect is to freak the students out.
Wow. That is Roque Planas, national reporter with the Huffington Post. Julio, can you hear us now?
I made it.
Oh, good. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Julio Ricardo Varela. He's a senior digital editor with Latino USA. Sorry about that, Julio. You've been covering this AP report on Twitter all morning, and you've been following reaction from the White House. Talk a little bit, first off, what are your initial thoughts on this AP piece? According to the story, governors in 11 states, including Oregon, Oklahoma, Arkansas, California, would have a choice whether to have their National Guard troops participate. This is according to a memo written by U.S. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, a retired four-star Marine general.
Mm-hmm. Well, just so people know that Ryan Beckwith of Time Magazine actually tweeted out the full 11-page draft memo about an hour ago. And it already has like close to 1,300 retweets. So what the Associated Press reported about this 11-page draft memo and not making that memo available, now it's available on Twitter. And I actually just tweeted it out from my handle. But anyway, so I haven't had a chance to even look at the memo. I literally was looking at my Twitter feed as I was waiting to call in. And but what's really interesting about all this is how quickly Sean Spicer in the White House denied that story.
Hmm.
You know, that, you know, within, I believe, 15 to 20 minutes of the Associated Press story breaking, and it just took off, right? Because it feels like Roque is saying, it feels like every 6 hours something else is happening in the immigration space since the January 25th executive orders. But this memo is just kind of adding more fuel to the fire. My sense is that people are kind of when they saw Spicer's denial, at least people that are kind of in the anti, you know, people that are following the news and are kind of in the anti-Trump camp, they're already questioning the denial. But I think there's something to be said about how quickly the White House tweeted this out and now saying that this is not true. But who knows? Who knows what's true or not? And who knows what's being discussed? The fact that a memo is out there talking about the National Guard and immigration enforcement should create some pause in all this.
And I'm looking right now to get some reaction. Homeland Security Department says, quote, absolutely incorrect. So as a journalist, Julio, who follows these issues so closely, what do you do when a piece like this breaks from the AP with this kind of information? And then as you see, as Roque pointed out, Sean Spicer, you know, quickly reacted and said this is 100% not true. At that point, what moves should journalists make?
Well, one thing that people should know is that the AP has done things in the past that weren't correct, right? I think there was a situation, I believe, from like 3 or 4 years ago with Senator Rand Paul that the AP produced a statement that the senator never gave. And I'm not suggesting that the AP is in the world of fake news, or that's not what I mean. But I also think in this day and age, especially in the world of digital journalism, especially in the world of, like, everything's breaking on Twitter or on Facebook, if you're going to go out and report a memo that's 11 pages and you're interpreting that memo as a journalist and you're not sharing the memo in this day and age, I, as a journalist, want to see that memo first before I even begin to start reacting to it and start reporting on it. I think when the White House, when you have President Trump kind of chastising the media or journalists in general, I think it's incumbent upon journalists now to be even more transparent about where they got this information, because it. And again, I'm not saying that what the AP reported was not true, but in this day and age, like, people are going to question everything. So you just got to publish it all. If it's true, if you got this information, you might as well just say, like, we got it. Here it is. Let's embed it, because things are going to change so quickly, and then it just creates this sort of like chaotic like news telling, and it's really hard for journalists to kind of sift through all this.
Well, and again, the AP is reporting that the Trump administration is considering a plan to mobilize as many as 100,000 National Guard troops to detain immigrants, even in places like Portland, Oregon. But White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer says the report is not true. And Nicholas Kung is a reporter with the Toronto Star, where he covers immigration. And Nicholas, can you hear us?
Yeah, sorry about the problem we had earlier.
Okay, great. I'm sorry about that. So, Nicholas, you report on immigration issues from Canada, and I just wonder, as a journalist north of us, what are you making of all of the news that is happening here in the States and news like the breaking news that just came down this morning by the AP?
It's certainly, you know, the new administration has kept a lot of Canadian journalists very busy, especially on my beat too, since the executive orders were issued. Actually, it's kind of interesting what Julia was saying earlier about today's breaking news on the memo to mobilize National Guard troops to round up unauthorized immigrants. That's the first story that I, you know, started tweeting this morning, and immediately, you know, the kind of response from people on Twitter is, you know, basically questioning, you know, whether this is fake news. How do we know? There's, you know, again, they raised the question, where's the draft?
Right.
That's the first thing that, you know, people wanted to know. I think, you know, at this day and age, I don't know why reporters, you know, we are respected, we have a good reputation, even at the Toronto Star, the largest newspaper in Canada, that, you know, we have to justify what we do and not, you know, our facts. I just find it very interesting in that regards. A lot of people, you know, actually, you know, a lot of Canadians really concerned about what's happening in the States. We follow the coverage on the immigration front really closely since the executive orders actually came out. just because, you know, how, you know, intertwined, you know, the two countries are. I personally, I have a brother, a sister, you know, family members living in the States. And there are also a lot of, you know, cultural exchange happening between two countries, you know, students. And certainly, you know, it's a huge, you know, today's news, you know, may not be, you know, as big, you know, in Canada, just because, you know, we're talking about unauthorized immigrants currently living in the States.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the relationship between the United States and Canada. Last weekend, you reported on this, Nicholas, a group of 22 asylum seekers, including a child and a baby, walked from North Dakota to Canada in freezing thick snow. And I just really can't get my mind off of this story, especially the one about what happened over Christmas, where two refugees from Somalia and Ghana suffered severe frostbite and lost fingers. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, tell us about this relationship between the United States and Canada, this agreement that's called the Safe Third Country Agreement.
Basically, the Safe Third Country Agreement was signed back in 2004, which essentially stops refugees from filing asylum claims in both Canada and the U.S. They have to file an asylum claim if they want to at the place in the country of first arrival. And as a result, if a refugee first arrived in the States and tried to cross the official port of entry, they would be turned back at the border, except, you know, there are, you know, four exempted groups, but there's a very small number of people who actually would be allowed to cross the border, the port of entry, to file asylum claim in Canada. And I think with the kind of anti-immigrant, anti-refugee rhetorics, you know, people are hearing in the States, a lot of them, you know, the only way for these refugees to cross the border is to take the illegal route, meaning crossing unguarded borders, risking their lives to cross the border. What is interesting here is the kind of response that we've had, you know, Canadians have had, and you know, in light of the reports of the irregular entries or the growing number of irregular entries, is, you know, the first concern, you know, I think from most readers was, how can we help? And one thing was, you know, a lot of people, including academics and lawyers, they actually demanded the Canadian government to temporarily suspend the Safe Third Country Agreement in order to allow safe passage for the refugees coming into Canada from the States, instead of risking their lives, like losing their limbs or died on, you know, in their journey to Canada. As well, we also have our politicians so far have not responded to the request. But I think what is interesting is the kind of response from Canadians. Like, I'm not saying that we are better, we are more humanitarian, but certainly I think it has a lot to do with the fact that one in every five Canadians actually foreign-born, which is equivalent to 7 million of our 35 million population. And I think I was actually doing a little bit of research before today's interview that I think in the States only 13% of Americans actually are foreign-born. And I think, you know, that might, you know, be, you know, might speaks to, you know, our approach to immigration and refugees.
You wrote a story about a Harvard report that says Ottawa should suspend the refugee pact with the United States because so many people are risking their lives to walk into Canada.
Yep. Yeah. And I think that was actually, I would say that's a very good legal analysis. When you have such a reputable education institution coming out and urge, you know, the policymakers to take such a stance, I think it gives more credibility to Canadian, you know, citizens who concern about, you know, the safety and the well-being of these refugees. But because also, I think before that Harvard report came out, just earlier we had law professors from across Canada signing this petition to issue the same demand on our parliament And I think, you know, that Harford report actually, you know, would give the more credibility to the concerns of the law professors.
And that is Nicholas Kung. He's a reporter with the Toronto Star, the largest newspaper in Canada. Roque Planas is national reporter for the Huffington Post. And Julio Ricardo Varela is senior digital editor with Latino USA. Nicholas, the story of the two men who suffered severe frostbite and lost their fingers is getting a lot of attention here in the United States. CNN actually sent a reporter up there to interview these two men. What are your thoughts about the coverage this is getting, and how has this changed over the last couple of years, just in terms of the people going through, for example, North Dakota to get to Canada?
I think, you know, maybe I can give you a little bit of context from the Canadian perspective, because obviously the refugee crisis is not new, especially, you know, when we talk about the Syrians. Since the Syrian uprising, you know, we are, you know, now at the unprecedented number of displaced people around the world, according to the UNHCR. And I think what happened with these two gentlemen during Christmas time crossing the border into Canada really put a human face. I think in the, you know, here in North America, we're pretty blessed in terms of, because of our geographical boundaries, we have been quite isolated from the refugee crisis that we are seeing, we have been seeing in Europe. And I think, you know, with the in the bigger context, you know, with a new presidential administration in the States and the orders, and, you know, something that I want to bring out too is about the recent massacre at one of our mosques here in Quebec in January, where, you know, a number of people, Muslims, brothers, and got killed in the massacre. Mm. And I think it you know, gives the a bigger context of, you know, it's actually brings, you know, the faces of the two individuals and all these issues, like put a human face behind all these issues. And now, you know, we sort of, you know, I'm sure you're aware that Canada actually accepted 25,000. Actually, as of today, we have accepted 40,000 Syrian refugees as of the end of January to resettle them in Canada. And I think, you know, but you know, to see, you know, people actually taking such risks to come, you know, it brings that, you know, the situation in Europe that much closer to us.
Right.
And but what is interesting in terms of our coverage, again, you know, it's not about how we could keep these people out of the country, is about how we could facilitate the entry. And it's interesting, you know, it goes back to, you know, the close relationship between the U.S. and Canada. We, you know, for example, you know, the Women's March, you know, we have so many Canadians trying to cross the border to join the march as well. And I think just that humanitarian approach is actually quite different between the two administrations.
And before we let you go, Nicholas, what are you working on right now?
I'm currently actually working on a story of about citizenship in Canada. One that, you know, we're actually seeing more and more Canadian citizens having their citizenship revoked, while the number of people, immigrants, trying to apply for citizenship actually drastically going down. And at the time when we tried to foster, you know, sense of belonging and civil participation into the society.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Nicholas Kung is a reporter with the Toronto Star, where he covers immigration, refugee, and migrant issues. You can find his stories at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we'll continue our conversation with Roque Planas, national reporter with the Huffington Post, and Julio Ricardo Varela, senior digital editor with Latino USA. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. Coming up on Monday, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had about how environmental photographers are documenting the impacts of climate change. And then on Tuesday, we'll have a conversation with Dr. Willie Parker. He provides abortions in the South, the part of the country with the most restrictive laws on the books. I hope you can tune in for that conversation. Dr. Parker is in town receiving an award from Planned Parenthood. Today, it is our media roundtable, and this is the day that we talk to reporters about coverage of the week's news, and we've been doing a week-long series on immigration. If you missed any of our shows, you can find them at yourcallradio.org. And we got some breaking news this morning. Again, the AP is reporting that the Trump administration is considering a plan to mobilize National Guard troops to detain immigrants, including millions living nowhere near the Mexico border. The White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer says the report is 100% not true. And then there's a report by NBC about members of Congress who recently met with a top ICE official. Based on that meeting, they say they're now concerned that all undocumented immigrants in the United States are at risk of deportation. We're talking about this with Roque Planas, national reporter with The Huffington Post, and Julio Ricardo Varela, senior digital editor with Latino USA. And Roque, I wanted to ask you, Nicholas was talking about, you know, putting a human face on these numbers and this story. We've been doing that all week. You and Julio both cover these stories consistently, and now we're seeing so much more coverage in the national media. What are your thoughts on the media really putting a human face on these issues?
Well, I mean, I think it's something that we really have to do. One of the things that I think is probably been a really big shift in the thinking about immigration within sort of the immigrant rights communities and so forth is that, you know, in Obama's outgoing years, he really sort of created this cleavage between what a lot of people refer to as the good immigrant and the bad immigrant, right? Mm-hmm. There was all of this groundswell of support for Dreamers who are very easy to sympathize with, as they should be, right? Because they're, you know, basically American, educated in this country, you know, et cetera. But I think there was a sort of tendency among the news media and among the political class to sort of hold up a sort of valedictorian, you know, high-achieving person as the model immigrant while saying we're going to get rid of all these criminals, right? And that's the sort of Obama's outgoing sort of DAPA, you know, thing, felons, not, or families, not felons, whatever it was. But, you know, when you're looking at what's happened now, right, discretion has gone out the window. There's no, you know, it's contained right there in that sanctuary cities executive order that Donald Trump put out, right? So when Democrats are saying they're worried that every undocumented immigrant is a priority, well, that's very clearly stated already official policy from the Trump administration. And so when you start looking at the people who were rounded up in this Operation Crosscheck that detained, you know, some like more than 680 people or however many it was, but it was around there, right? What you're seeing is a lot of people without criminal records, but then a lot of people with very minor criminal records, you know, people with marijuana charges or people who, you know, there was the case of the guy who had DACA and they're accusing him of being in a gang because he has a tattoo in Spanish, you know? These are...
It's called La Paz.
Yeah, which says peace, right? So, I mean, I think that one of the things about putting a human face on this is that I think, you know, I would urge reporters not to trash a story about an immigrant just because that person may have a DUI or some kind of criminal record, because the fact of the matter is that in immigrant communities, which are largely people of color, their criminal histories are going to be overrepresented. You know, in New York City where I live, you're not going to see cops shaking down guys on Wall Street to see if they got cocaine or guns. Mm. But you will see that all over the place in, you know, Queens and further out. And so the result is that people have all these you know, much overrepresented criminal records, and you have to talk to people to understand the situation they're in.
And this is nothing new, because professors from Cornell and the University of California looked at coverage from the New York Times since the 80s, and they have found a consistent negative tone in stories about immigration, and most of them focus on Latinos. And they concluded that since the 80s, this has really shaped public opinion, with a lot of Democrats saying that they're pro-immigration, Republicans saying they're anti, and these professors said you didn't see that major split back in the 80s. Roque, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think the general tone of the news media looked at immigration as a criminal issue rather than as an economic or humanitarian one. So there's that issue right off the bat. I also think that the Democrats struggle with a very confused message. If you listen to what Republicans say about immigration, right, it's always secure the border. And, you know, it could be that they're talking in terms often that don't have clear metrics, that are a recipe for just massive government spending that's quite ineffective and all that stuff. But the message is very clear. Whereas from Democrats, it's much more like, oh, well, you know, we need to get these people without the criminal records, and we need to do this and that, but, you know, but we have to secure the border too. And it's this sort of confusing. You won't hear any Democrats say, I believe in open borders, for example, which would be the counter extreme, right? So the result is a very muddled message. You won't find people that are trying to say, you know, the border with Mexico should look a lot more like the border between Alabama and Georgia. But there's economic and humanitarian arguments to be considered there.
Mm. And when I say Democrats, I should say that the study focused on citizens, not politicians, and how the coverage affects public opinion about immigration. Roque, what's really struck you in the coverage that you've read and seen over the last couple of weeks? Because as someone who covers this issue as a beat, now it's getting national attention, and the national media have really broken a lot of important stories in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I think it's great. I mean, I think you have a lot of reporters sort of trying to track down these cases. You had Reuters breaking the case, breaking the story about the dreamer who was detained, and then, you know, there was another one in San Antonio. You had the El Paso story about a woman who went to the county courthouse seeking a protective order from domestic violence and was picked up by ICE agents there. So I feel like, you know, it's become a national story in a way that it wasn't in the Obama years. And I think that it's become, you know, something that the entire sort of news media is throwing a lot of energy at. I mean, I think it's great. I wish that there was this kind of attention put on immigration, you know, during the Trump campaign, because there's a lot of areas that are very underexplored in the way that our immigration system functions.
And what would you add, Julio?
I there's so much to talk about, but I just wanted to update your listeners. The Associated Press has released the memo as well in the last hour.
Hmm.
So if people want to see it, and there is a section of the memo that does speak about the National Guard, it's very, like, as a consideration, not necessarily as a, we're going to do this. So a lot of questions about that. And I guess the question from the White House is to say, like, whether the plan will be implemented or not. But no one can deny the fact now that it's not being discussed, because now there's a primary document that's been vetted. So I just wanted to make sure that people were informed of that. But to get back to the bigger issue, you know, what Roque's talking about, and also about the perception, you know, there is a perception, there is a history of this, as sort of, you know, the quote-unquote criminality of immigrants in this society, and especially in media. And I think that the mainstream English language sort of media that really dominates this country, is at fault. You know, is at fault. I mean, I Roque and I, we've been covering these stories for a while. And if people are surprised that, you know, that ICE bans have been blocked by protesters, or there have been calls for not more deportations, or that, you know, dreamers have been deported or have been arrested, then you missed the last 6 or 7 years of the Obama administration. And to all of a sudden suddenly say, like, this is all new news, that's not necessarily accurate. So I think what I'm just amazed by, and I don't know about you, Roque, but, you know, I would write stories about activists protesting, you know, the DNC or the White House or about the deportations about 3 or 4 years ago, and maybe they got picked up or maybe they didn't. But what I'm seeing now in the last week is that a lot of national outlets are almost like breaking the story. So the specific example is the woman in Colorado, in Denver, Jeanette Vizguerra, who publicly declared sanctuary just a couple of days after the woman from Arizona, Guadalupe Garcia de Rayos, was deported for checking in with ICE, and also the day after Daniel, who's the DACA individual whose court case is actually being heard right now in Seattle, she publicly declared sanctuary. So I wrote this piece for Latino USA going, oh, yeah, this is, you know, I've done this before. This was exactly the type of story I've written. But it was already on CNN and the New York Times within minutes of her announcing the sanctuary. So for me, it's like, yes, there's more attention, and I think a lot of the work that the immigrant rights activists have been doing the last couple of years is finally moving up the media chain. But at the same time, I just wonder why. Where was this attention even 3 or 4 years ago when the same points were being made about the Obama administration? Although I think the question of how the Trump administration is blanketly starting to say that, you know, immigration attorneys now are saying it's pretty much anybody. That's the biggest difference right now. But to not say that the Obama administration did not set this up or has not, this is more than a consequence of immigration policy of the Obama administration is not true. Look at the last, you know, 2011 to 2015, you know, when there were ICE raids that arrested 3,000 people in a 5-day sweep. And that's, I'm not making that up. Go to ICE.gov, look at Operation Crosscheck. You know, these things were happening. There were many more arrests that were happening under the Obama administration. But the big question now is the net been widened? And is the transparency of ICE, because the last point I'll make about all this is that President Trump is calling for a public list of crimes, you know, quote-unquote crimes committed by immigrants, and that goes against the privacy policy of ICE. So right now, President, if you look at the executive order in January, it basically is allowing the federal government to reveal the privacy of non-U.S. citizens for any crimes they commit. That goes against ICE policy, and ICE has already gone on record saying we have to rethink our privacy policy, because usually to get information from ICE, you have to submit a Freedom of Information Act. It takes a while; they get denied. But this executive order, you know, there's been a lot of calls by immigrants' rights activists to make the list public, because then we'll really understand who had a misdemeanor or who doesn't have a criminal record and who does. So it's a lot; it's very complicated.
Hmm. Julio Ricardo Varela is senior digital editor for Latino USA, NPR's only national Latino news weekly radio show. And Roque Planas is national reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers immigration. Today we're talking about media coverage of the ICE raids, immigration, and you heard Julio talk about the AP report that the Trump administration is considering a plan to mobilize up to 100,000 National Guard troops to detain immigrants. The White House says this report is not true. I also want to ask you both about a little bit of history here, because we've done shows again all week, and some of our guests have talked about why their families came here in the first place. For example, Julio Prieto, a senior at UC Berkeley who's undocumented, said his family came because of NAFTA. There's a good story over at CNN called Mexican Farmer's Daughter, NAFTA Destroyed Us. This reporter interviewed a number of people who were in their 20s when NAFTA passed, and their fathers had to flee because their farmer fathers had to flee because they could no longer afford to make ends meet by selling corn. And I also wanted to ask you, you both have written about Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes, the woman who was deported to Mexico from Arizona on Thursday. She's been here since she was 14. Now she's 36. She's a mother of two. And earlier this week, one of our guests, Bill Ong Hing, who teaches law at USF, said he spoke with her lawyer. And the reason why she came here when she was 14 is because of NAFTA. But he said hardly any of the stories that he's read point that out. Can you talk about the importance of that, Roque?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think NAFTA was tremendously politicized in the this last presidential campaign, and for some reasons that I think are valid. But I don't think that people really understand the agreement's role in sort of spurring immigration. And at the time that NAFTA was signed into law, Mexico was going through this massive baby boom, years of economic stagnation, right? And that's right. Really the sort of tipping point, like the highest peak of the mass migration from Mexico to the United States. It's 1990s. I mean, it's basically over now, at least from Mexico. And so, you know, what you saw there, right, was that with U.S. subsidized agriculture going in, Mexico loses somewhere between 2 and 3 million agricultural jobs. And where do they go? Right? They go to places like Juarez. They go to places like Nogales, right on the U.S. border, to work in maquilas and other, you know, assembly plants and so forth, where the money that's being made there isn't Mexican capital, it's foreign capital. So the profits that are going there, right, they leave Mexico. I mean, this agreement in a lot of ways made Mexico poorer. I mean, I'm sure there's arguments that you could say that it also, you know, helped spur their economic development in some ways, but this effect on pushing people out of the country was very real. I mean, if you go to, I mean, it was just in Juarez the other day, and the people that are working in these maquilas are making, you know, $40, $50 a week.
Wow.
To work for this tremendously grueling labor. Now, I mean, if you're a stone's throw from the United States, it's a very obvious decision for you, particularly if you have a family. I mean, I shouldn't say it's obvious because I don't think a lot of people want to migrate. But I mean, if that's the situation you're in, there's a tremendous pull to leave. And the United States had, you know, a big part in sort of liberating capital to go over to Mexico, but not liberating the labor market. They were trying to constrict the labor market at the same time as they were trying to let capital do whatever it wants. And you can't have both. You know, right. You need to give people the opportunity to work, you know, and that's what the vast majority of people who were coming here in the 1990s were doing. Now it's a lot of people seeking protection from violence, but in the 1990s, that's what immigration looked like. And they came here and they did work, you know.
Right.
Some commit crimes, but not on the level of native-born people. I mean, it's like, you know, that argument doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it's like, you know, well, what? We have a criminal justice system that deals with crime, you know, and we have a civil immigration system that deals with immigration. And what you're seeing is that they're becoming increasingly entwined.
Right.
And Trump's very aware of that, and so is Jeff Sessions, the attorney general. And you're
going
to see, like in Travis County where I live, where they tried to do the sanctuary policy, ICE responded by asking the U.S. attorney to prosecute people in the county jail for illegal reentry if they had a prior deportation. That's a felony charge that carries a minimum of 2 years, and depending on your criminal record, if you had like a drug charge or something like that, it can get enhanced, you know, all the way up, depending on the crime, to 20 years.
Right. And I think just to follow up on Roque's point before, you talking about NAFTA and Bill Clinton, because I want to make a point about President Clinton. But one of the things that people need to notice, and it's actually become a pattern now with the president, is what I call the 1-2-3 sort of logic of his immigration policy. Basically, he did it again during the press conference, the massive press conference that everyone's talking about. He starts with, you know, violence, you know, what's going on in Chicago? You know, this is all bad, and it's because of drugs, and that's why we need to stop the drug cartels, and that's why we need to have a border wall, and that's why we need to protect this country from immigrants, because it's a terrorism issue, and that's why we need to build a wall. So the wall has now become sort of this, you know, it's going to solve every social problem in the United States of America, an economic problem. And whatever people, whatever they want to say about that, that's the strategy of the Trump administration, and people need to admit that it's working with his supporters. It doesn't have any logic, but that's what's going on. But to push back to NAFTA, you know, I don't know if people remember in 1995 when Bill Clinton was running, or 1996 when Bill Clinton was running against Bob Dole. There's a national commercial of Clinton, and it basically is, you know, it had the same type of, you know, it's very similar to Trump immigration commercials, where it's like President Bill Clinton has deported more people than anyone in the history of the United States. He believes in border security and stopping, you know, and it's very pro enforcement. And he painted Bob Dole as sort of the weak on immigration candidate. And you look at the irony of that. There's a lot of things that President Clinton did that, and again, Donald Trump has taken it to an extreme, but to say that Donald Trump is sort of this new voice that just happened, there's a history of, you know, keeping people out, and there's a history of the effects that NAFTA has brought, which came under the Clinton administration. And for people for those that are still looking at this as sort of like a Republican Democrat, there's a paradigm, there's a difference. Political history does not prove that. And I think what I'm seeing, and a lot of the things that we focus on Latino USA, is that a lot of these young, you know, the children of the parents of the 90s, understand that context of NAFTA and Clinton and border enforcement, because that's where they came from, right? So that's what they were taught. So when you start making the connection of these young Latinos who are probably in their 20s or early 30s, starting to question why the Democratic Party is, in a lot of ways, can be just as false as Republican rhetoric, that's where it's coming from. So this is all connected, and it's one of the points that very few people in the media, especially I'm talking cable news right now, they don't even know, like, it's so simplistic, the debate, that that's what I fear is happening now, that it's too much of a either or, when in fact there's such a complicated history that has gone on around this topic.
Right, and the history is so important. The other thing I wanted to ask you both, we don't have that much time, but earlier this week we got a few emails from people saying that, you know, your show is one-sided, you're not talking about the housing and the jobs and everything else, that it changes when immigrants come to this country. In fact, we had a couple callers this morning who hung up, but they said that immigrants come here to get handouts from the U.S. government. I wanted to ask you both about this, because I looked at some numbers this morning from the Center for American Progress, and I haven't seen much reporting on this angle at all, but according to this report, immigrants and other foreign-born individuals are severely restricted in terms of the federal public assistance they can access. Even green card holders are generally ineligible for Medicaid, SNAP, which is the food stamp program, SSI, and the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. They did a survey last year and found that low-income immigrant-headed households are less likely than households headed by those born in the U.S. to participate in SNAP or to participate in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. Roque, can you comment on this?
Sure, yeah, and I think it's an important point, because it's intertwined with why Latino voter turnout is so low. And I think I'll try to get all that quickly, but basically, you know, when you're looking at that, right, what you're seeing, I mean, so let me back up. There is some concern about how mass migration can lower wages within certain job sectors if you have a lot of unskilled labor coming into a job market. I mean, I think that's true. The net effect is for the economy to grow. But if you're looking at immigration, right, and you're trying to understand its effect on labor, you know, you're not going to explain away why people don't have manufacturing jobs. If you want to understand why the American public has a legitimate concern about its salaries, you need to go back and look at why the American, like, why local governments have been systematically defunding their own people's educations, right, for reasons that have nothing to do with immigration, you know, and why, you know, public assistance to the native born is limited. I mean, we had this huge debate over Obamacare, and now they're going to, you know, they're talking about repealing it. And that wasn't even something that extended health insurance to everyone. We don't even have a consensus that American-born people should have health insurance in this country. So, I mean, if you're trying to understand why Americans don't have jobs, it has a lot to do with federal and local and state policymakers not investing in native-born people's educations and job training. So that's one point, right? But the other thing is that immigrants, when they come into this country, tend to be very self-reliant, whether or not they have papers, right? It's just a sort of dynamic, especially when you're dealing with people from Latin America, right? Because people from Latin America, imagine this, right? You come in the 1990s, with or without papers, from Chihuahua State, right? And you come from a place where, you know, some things that you might hear, right? Like if there was a homicide committed and the police won't investigate without a tip. You come from a place where maybe your vote doesn't count, you know, because of local corruption. And you come from a place where working is tremendously difficult. So the mentality that has grown up in the United States, particularly in the Southwest and heavily immigrant communities, to be very self-reliant. Health insurance, right, may not be available to people, so they turn to mutual aid societies or the church. So And that's why you see a very high level of entrepreneurialism, right? Because people depend on themselves, and you do not see a high level of civic engagement because people come from a culture in which if you have a problem, you didn't go to the local government and say, oh, I'm going to get elected. You know, there was tremendous disincentive to political activity, particularly talking about Central Americans who came here during the 80s and 90s who were fleeing from war. So I think, you know, those two things, right, they're very intertwined. The immigrant groups from Latin America, particularly people that come, you know, from a, like, sort of low-skilled background or from countries that were impoverished or in violence, do not seek public assistance automatically. That, I mean, that's actually, ironically enough, it's in the Cuban-American community where you'll see a much higher use of public assistance because of the traditional Cuban Adjustment Act. Anyways, I went on too long.
Thank you. It's important to talk about. Julio, just quickly, we've about a minute or so left. What would you add? And are you seeing much reporting about these issues? About what are the facts and the myths around what happens when immigrants come to the United States?
Yeah, I think the points that Brooke is saying about self-reliance is, I think what's the problem is that people don't have a good understanding in this country from a media perspective about mixed status families. And that's where it gets a little bit complicated. So, for example, you know, the parent might be a first-generation immigrant who does not have citizen status, but their children are. And that's where the myth becomes of, like, public assistance gets into the fact that, you know, U.S. citizens could get public assistance, but, you know, you're part of a mixed-status family. But that's not the main narrative. I mean, but it's an easy narrative to sell under a Trump administration, to the point that the Washington Post, talking about leaked memos, actually posted that as well last week, that, you know, they're trying to eliminate public assistance from legal immigrants. The numbers don't show there, and there's not a lot of real reporting about it because, again, it's always seen through partisan lenses. I mean, just the fact that you quoted CAP, you know, you know, people are going to be like, oh, she's in, you know, the Hillary Clinton campaign. And that's the problem. I think what's happened is we as journalists have not allowed ourselves to dive into this because when you do, you're already labeled as biased and partisan and political. And in fact, there are a lot of facts out there. We've done it at Latino USA to dispel those myths. But we're so siloed as a society right now in media consumption that I don't necessarily think that the impact of informing, you know, the entire American society about this fact is really hitting home, because people, the first thing they're going to say is fake news. You know,
wow.
If you don't like it, fake news. Sorry, I'm going to go read my Breitbart and I'm moving on.
Right. I mean, we are in uncharted territory right now, but it's still so important to find the facts and report
the truth.
Yeah, and I think we should do an entire hour just on the facts and the myths surrounding immigration so we can all do our research and then bring it to the show. Julio Ricardo Varela is a senior digital editor with Latino USA. Roque Planas is national reporter with the Huffington Post. Julio and Roque, thank you for joining us. Thanks for your reporting.
It was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy is assistant producer. David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.